Okay. So this year marks the 40th anniversary of the Cortex textile factory strike in Brunswick, Melbourne. A strike led by migrant women who fearlessly beat back paid thugs, police using batons with nothing more than their shoes and solidarity. Cortex was a sweatshop with... Cortex was a sweatshop with extremely low wages, a so-called bonus system, which really was just a way to speed up production and an excuse to fire people who didn't meet unrealistic targets. They experienced daily degradation with timed toilet breaks, racist and abusive managers and supervisors, many of whom were women, by the way. They only had one 10-minute tea break, no canteen, which forced workers to eat and smoke in the toilets. One striker described the conditions as being more akin to a jail than a factory. But for just over a week in December in 1981, these very same women outwitted and outsmarted not only their bosses, but also union organisers. And as a result, they won a significant pay rise, an additional holiday, and improvements to their working conditions. Not only that, but they smashed through sexist and racist stereotypes and in the course of the struggle transformed themselves. They went back to work with their heads held high and managers put on notice. Some of the women went on to be involved in a whole series of other strikes and picket lines and demonstrations over following years. I'm really excited to get to share this really wonderful history with you all. Researching this talk was such an inspiring reminder about the power of the working class and their ability to challenge oppression. I want to thank actually all of the workers in the Cortex strike. Their courageous fight not only won them better conditions, but it stands as a testament to our power today if only the unions will use it. Migrant workers are often talked about as mere victims, but the Australian labour movement is full of stories of migrant workers giving the establishment a bloody nose. These battles have never just been to the benefit of migrants alone, but have actually lifted the entire working class as part of the broader struggle. And of course, that tradition continues in many ways today. I've been extremely proud and honoured to stand on picket lines all around Melbourne with workers from all over the world. And of course, yesterday, just in here, we had heard stories from migrant farm workers who I think are doing some of the most significant industrial organising at the moment. In particular, I'd like to thank Bari Acklin. Bari was a participant in the Cortex strike and is also the grandmother to our comrade Ravan. Ravan sat down and interviewed his grandmother, this great unsung working class hero, and translated her answers into English for me because unlike many of the women in the strike, I unfortunately only speak one language. So I'll be drawing a lot on her experience from the strike in this story. The only other account, and I dare say actually that no one would really know anything about this strike today if it weren't for Sandra Bloodworth, who's also here today. At the time of the strike, Sandra was a young organiser with the International Socialists. The IS were virtually the only people who thought this story was worth telling. In many ways, it's not surprising, given that this was a strike against their own union officials, that the union doesn't particularly record this history. The only other account that I could find was a very brief reference to it by a strike participant in a migrant workers' newspaper at the time. So this is their story. On Friday, the 27th of November, there was to be a union meeting at the Cortex factory to discuss a campaign for a $25 an hour pay rise. When the officials from the union didn't even bother to show up, the women walked out and decided to set up a picket the following Monday. On Monday morning, about 300 workers picketed the factory. They successfully stopped trucks and marched to another nearby factory and brought more workers out on strike with them. No doubt, as the women stood their ground against that first truck that rolled up to the picket line, they had some apprehension, but that was quickly to change, which Sandra explains in this podcast.
And the experience of seeing them the first trucks that came that they were trying to stop going in, the trucks that were, or TWU, the transport workers, they'd been winning pay rises and things. And we said to them, go up and talk to the drivers, you know, explain why this is a picket, they can't go in. And then when they did, the truck, this huge truck in this little street in Brunswick coming up to the factory, and he says, oh, no worries, Nate, and turns the truck around. And the women just, like, the level of confidence just skyrocketed, and people were singing and dancing and, you know, strengthening the pickets. And so from then on, it was obvious that this was going to be a fight to try to win.
So, yeah, if you haven't heard that whole podcast yet, I really recommend that you go back and check it out on A People's History of Australia. So the fact that the truck drivers had little to do with the women previously, that they were all men, that they were mostly white, didn't matter at all. They had solidarity with these women. They recognised their collective struggle and expressed basic working class solidarity. From the first day, the strikers were up against a heavy and violent presence of company goons who threatened them with the sack, security guards who were later pulled off by their own union, and cops. Bari remembers the police sporadically attacking the picket line with batons, but with their newfound collective strength, this didn't really faze the women. They took off their shoes, the young women rushed to the front and beat back their attackers with their shoes. Yeah, look at these losers. Useless. So when the company attempted to bring in scabs under police guard, the women would call out to them in their own languages and more often than not convince the workers to turn around and join the picket line. And when they did, the picket line would erupt in cheers and celebration welcoming the newcomers. Eventually, this became somewhat of a game, breaking the spirit of the employers. Sometimes, as well as celebrating, there would be laughter when the strikers welcomed new picketers. It turns out that they were getting their friends or themselves marching up as if they were going to go into work just to do like a dramatic turnaround to join the strikers. Being an unofficial strike, this was very much organised and led by the rank and file. The picket line was much more lively and engaged than many. This was far from the sort of top-down affair that you often see, or unfortunately don't often see enough of, really. The women knew how to draw their communities into this strike. There was much cultural singing and dancing. Many of the Turkish women would use a high-pitched trill, kind of keep the energy up on the picket line. There were even songs sung in Turkish about cutting out the tongues of the officials. We should bring that back. The multiple cultures and languages represented on the picket line were a source of strength. The different languages didn't prove to be a barrier at all. Many of the strikers spoke multiple languages and could translate back and forth. And Bari talks about the fact that they kind of developed their own language and their own hand signals to coordinate the picket line. On the second day of the strike, the women had their self-organisation and strength tested as the union called a mass meeting intended to put an end to the wildcat strike. They bussed in workers from factories who were not on strike, and they fought to keep the socialists who'd been welcome on the picket line out, but brought in the company goons. The leading role played by the Turkish Revolutionary Organisation, the Victorian Turkish Labourers Association, VTAB, is really important here. The most leading militants on the picket line were Turkish women, and a number of them were members of VTAB. They refused to rely on the translator supplied by the union, and instead Sultan, one of the strikers and a VTAB member, did the translating for them. The union pushed for the strikers to accept the $13.50 being offered by arbitration. The strikers expressed outrage at this position. While the officials attempted to enforce a secret ballot, the women fought to force a vote to be by division of the room. Accountability in a vote has always been an important democratic principle of the workers' movement. Employers try to force our votes to be taken secretly because it's a source of strength for them. Having forced a vote by division, the women won. The strike would continue, and now, because the union had brought workers from other factories in the hopes of shutting things down, the strike had to be made official and spread. So instead of shutting down one strike, the workers had managed to grow their strike. On Wednesday, the union officials were tried on again with another mass meeting intended to stop the strike. Having been shown up by the strikers the previous day, this time in a sickening display of aggressive class collaboration, they brought in the employers and worked closely with the bosses. The bosses brought busloads of scabs with "We Want Work" placards and megaphones to ensure that they could be heard over the rather noisy strikers. The goons were given access to the meeting hall again. When men from VTAB tried to fight them, the striking women pulled them aside. "Get out of the way. We know how to fight." And, you know, use those trusty shoes again. The union once more tried to push the arbitration deal, and this time the officials and the supervisors did manage to secure a secret ballot. Fat lot of good it did them, though. During the vote, supervisors were standing over the ballot boxes, ripping up the ballots. The bosses' stooges were voting multiple times. So the Cortex women, giving absolutely no fucks for proper meeting procedure or orderly conduct, go on a total rampage, talking to and agitating loudly to all the workers about the need to support the strike. They managed to nick a couple of the megaphones from the bosses to use them to spread their own message. The fights with the goons continued. The bosses, of course, were horrified by these scenes and soon realised that the strikers were infecting their own workforce. And so in a panic, they start trying to evacuate the people that they brought with them and, you know, shove them onto buses, declaring that the vote a farce. Some of the older women in the room did feel a bit confronted and demoralised by this, and some of them went and sat outside. The young women, on the other hand, really threw themselves into the fray and just continued arguing and fighting, doing what they had to do. You know, taking a leaf out of the bosses' books, they also started voting multiple times. They would later laughingly defend themselves, saying, "Oh, we were just helping the older women." By the end of the whole thing, there were 362 votes to go back to work, 365 to stay out, in a meeting of 500. Again, the Cortex strikers had shown up the bosses and the union officials. And what I love about this story is their total disregard for any of the rules. One of the most like irritating liberal slogans at the moment is Michelle Obama's, when they go low, we go high. Give me a break. The rules weren't written for any of us. They were written for those at the top. And even when they do break their own rules, it gets covered up for. They get protected by those in power. So a little bit of organised chaos is often exactly what's needed. Can you imagine, though, those smug bosses and union officials? They thought they were so smart. They thought they'd have this stitched up in no time, only to be made to literally flee their own strike-breaking meeting by rank-and-file working-class women. So the strike and the lively picketing continues. And on Friday, the 4th of December, the officials call a negotiating meeting in the factory. Having to send in a small delegation to this negotiating meeting was the first time since the beginning of the picket that the women started to feel a bit apprehensive. Predictably, the bosses and the union officials stood over them in this arena, and it was accepted that they would take a deal, the arbitration offer of $13.50, with the addition of a delayed pay rise of $11.50. So eventually equaling the $25, and not quite on the timeline that they'd wanted, as well as improvements to, but not total abolition of the bonus system, an increased break, but no end to the timed toilet breaks. So as all strikes inevitably must within the framework of capitalism, this strike ended with a compromise. I have no doubt that had the workers stuck it out a little bit longer, they could have won even more. Nonetheless, these were significant gains, and you can't just assess the gains based on what's in the bit of paper that's signed at the end of the day. The gains are also reflected in the transformation that occurred for these women that turned them into self-confident fighters. If you can beat up a cop with your shoes, you're not going to be so easily bullied by these petty supervisors. Bari, after initially being nervous about losing her job on the first day of the strike, goes on to be immensely proud of what they achieved and becomes a regular on picket lines, union protests, and peace marches. She tells this great story about one day after the strike, she's at work and she manages to like prick her finger, causing injury, and some supervisor is really rude to her, tells her off. So she gets up, marches out, doesn't come back for 2 days. And she says that when she came back, the manager was very apologetic and never irritated her again. Bari says, she was a great friend to me after that, although this newfound friendliness was a bit unfortunate because apparently the supervisor had really bad breath. So Sultan, who I mentioned earlier as one of the leading activists in the strike, had basically never done serious public speaking before. And then in the process of this strike, she's up there in mass meetings of 500 or so people, you know, and not just like speaking, but making arguments into, you know, incredibly hostile forces with people who are supposedly your betters, who are meant to know how this runs. I think it's like quite an impressive transformation that happens. And I'm sure there's lots of different stories like both of those. And there is just one more, I guess, collective example of this. Just a few weeks later, the women managed to win themselves an extra half day holiday. They collectively decided to finish work early on Christmas Eve and held a party in the factory. And the bosses were just not game to try to stop them. So that went on to be an annual tradition. And according to Bari, the workers would pool their money to buy roast chicken and people would bring in dishes from their home. So workers got to share in each other's culture. I think in a workplace where bosses had historically divided workers up and pit them against, you know, each other on the basis of ethnicity, this is a pretty significant achievement. Though workers don't benefit from the sorts of divisive ideas like racism and nationalism, they can take up the ideas pushed from above. But in the context of struggle, these ideas are just so patently ridiculous. The strike is effective precisely because everyone is involved, regardless of gender, ethnicity, religion, or, you know, other perceived differences. So I want to pause now and play the clip of Bari.
Benim adım Bahriye Akalın. Portes grevindeydim. Orada çalışıyordum. Bugünün gençliği de haklarını arasınlar. Her şeyi kazanırlar.
Benim adım Bahriye Akalın. The union, yeah, I mean, there's just, history is just full of people who have just shaped the way that we live our lives that we just never know about. And Bari is just one of so many. The union officials at the time were dominated by white men who no doubt had, you know, backwards and paternalistic attitudes about migrant women. I'm sure the organising effort of these women was a huge shock to them. But I think it would be a real mistake to think that the officials' role in this can be entirely or even primarily explained by their gender or their whiteness. Union officials are not workers. They are a separate and distinct social layer. They do not share the interests of the working class, nor do they embody the power that's capable of fighting the bosses. At the time, one of the main arguments of union officials was to promote the accord. The accord promised union officials a seat at the table, as well as false promises of better welfare and social support for workers in return for industrial peace. One of the arguments used to promote this rotten class collaborationist policy was to argue that while in big industry of skilled white male workers, there was the possibility to use your industrial might, this left out those in less well-organized workplaces, particularly those dominated by women, the supposedly unskilled, and migrants. So instead, the best organized sections of the working class should supposedly sacrifice for the betterment of all. What a lie. After the accord is brought in 1983, actually workers' welfare and living standards fell at the same time that productivity and profits for the bosses rose. while the unions, with some notable honourable exceptions, collaborated with the government and employers to destroy solidarity and rank and file industrial power. For working class, it was sacrifice after sacrifice to ensure the survival of capitalism. The Financial Review, so no friends of ours, this is the boss's journal, summed up the results in 1989. Under the accord, the Australian Council of Trade Unions has deliberately facilitated the biggest redistribution of national income from wages to profits. The women of the Cortex factory, of course, show how crap this whole thing was. They show that far from being left out in the cold by better organised sections of the working class, they, in fact, were inspired by them. The very fact that unions like the car workers, the transport workers, the storemen and packers had won pay rises of $25 was exactly what inspired them to demand the same and to walk out and fight for it. You know, a lot of them had relatives, partners and others who'd been involved in other strikes. You know, when people see struggle, it can be infectious. It gives people a reason to fight back and hope that it's possible. And we see repeats of this same dead-end strategy come up time and time again, this idea that we should sacrifice, that there's somehow something noble, that we're going to somehow bring people up just by giving in to the bosses. Last year, Socialist Alternative members were involved in a national rank-and-file rebellion against the NTU officials, the union that represents university workers. It's a very similar argument that workers should accept pay cuts, that everyone should just like have their wages lowered, and that somehow this would protect jobs, protect casuals, and of course, even the employers said, yeah, no, it won't. Okay, so the dastardly role played by the union officials left, I think, a real space for an alternative political leadership, and VTAB were able to step into that. They were able to provide that alternative. As radical communists, VTAB understood the need for workers themselves to lead the struggle, and rather than look to make compromises with the bosses, workers had the power to bring Cortex to its knees, and they knew that. Their integration into the working class Turkish community put them in an ideal position to relate to migrant workers. And it wasn't just a question of industrial tactics. They had radical politics. They understood that sexism was not a question of just bad attitudes or a battle between men versus women. They understood that it was a class question. They held community events that included these really didactic plays, which were aimed at kind of educating workers about the way that sexism is used to divide the working class, and you know the importance of men, working class men, fighting sexism. You know, by for instance doing things like helping out at home to allow women to participate fully in the struggle. And Bari remembers that. She remembers the role that men played doing a lot of that kind of helping out work at home, which wouldn't have been as common back then. So it's again a real like indication of the way that struggle can change people. The international socialists also play a supporting role during this strike, doing things like handing out leaflets that had been developed by the strikers, producing placards that you know had the workers' main demands on them, and distributing the newspaper, The Battler, which carried significant socialist and industrial political reporting from the time. And our very own Mick, who I think is here, managed to get himself a black eye at that picket line. And as I mentioned earlier, it's Sandra's work that has ensured that the lessons from this history have been recorded, that we can, you know, learn from this strike, which, you know, is part of what we do. You know, Leon Trotsky made the argument that a socialist party needs to be the memory of the working class. So I want to play another clip from that podcast where Sandra talks briefly about the role of socialists in the strike, but also the impact that the strike had on her, because I think it's important to note that Marx and Marxists learnt about the incredible power that could transform society from the workers themselves.
Because it was one of the first big things I was involved in. I'd been at pickets and all kinds of things, and I'd been visiting workplaces for the anti-uranium mining movement, but I this just really touched my heart at the time.
Yeah.
And I loved all the women, and they taught me so much that strengthened my resolve to be a socialist.
Now, hopefully it strengthened your resolve to be a socialist as well, or convinced you that maybe you should. So next time that you hear some NGO type talk about sweatshop workers as these poor passive victims, I want you to know that these workers, garment workers, largely women, children, often migrants, have been some of the most incredible fighters for a better world. And some of them are up on the screen there, but there's a lot more. Andrew Tillett-Sarks, a labour organiser based in Myanmar, has argued that the sight of industrial workers, largely young women garment workers, seem to have deeply inspired the general public, broken down some of the fear and catalysed the massive protest and general strike we are seeing now. And even far from the kind of revolutionary example of Myanmar that we're seeing now, the strikes like the one at Cortex provide us with living proof of the power that workers have, the transformative nature of class struggle. The strike shows us too that it's important to build an alternative political leadership in the workers' movement, one which truly looks to the power of the working class themselves, which I guess is just one of the reasons that we ask you, if you haven't already, to join us in the project of building that sort of an organisation. Well, yeah, thanks so much, everybody, for coming, and thanks for that great discussion. It was wonderful that so many people wanted to speak and that so many people are taking inspiration from both the history and the current struggle of working class women and working class people around the world. Just another plug for that Rebel Women book. It was one of the first books that I read when I joined Socialist Alternative, and it's extremely inspiring. It has... it was mentioned before, it has a story about the 86 nurses strike, but also Sandra's account of the Cortex strike, the stories of women in Broken Hill. It's just full of great accounts of working class politics, and particularly of rebel women. So people should definitely check it out. I think, you know, it's true what Liz says about, you know, it's not necessarily automatic that, you know, class struggle just directly, like, washes away, fixes all of the kind of muck that capitalism brings with it. But it's also only class politics that can in any way seriously challenge the oppression of women, any oppression, any injustice. And it's one of the reasons it was so important and good that women are in the workforce. It's actually the fact that women work is the thing that gives them actually a basis to have equality. That is where women have power. It's not, you know, things like domestic strikes, like refusing to cook for your partner or your children. Like, fine, do that. I don't care. I mean, maybe don't starve the kids. I don't know. You've got to work something out there. But this doesn't actually this doesn't challenge capitalism. It doesn't challenge the root cause of women's oppression, whereas actually when we're in the workplace, we have the potential, we have the power to do that. And I think, you know, it's really been drawn out through a whole range of these sessions that our solidarity, our strength, lies in class and not in other sets of identity. You know, as I said before, women were some of the nastiest supervisors who oppressed, you know, these women who were responsible for degrading them on a daily basis, and working class men were the people who helped their strike succeed, who stood with them. You know, Sandra talked about, I was really reminded actually, you know, when Sandra's had her session about the Paris Commune, talked about really similar dynamics, that just absolute disgusting attitude and behaviour of the middle class and ruling class people, and women in particular, who revelled in all the pain and the suffering of working class people. And I wanted to just kind of mention, you know, Sandra in her talk talked about Napoleon Galliard, who was the you know, leader of the barricades in the Paris Commune and had been a shoemaker. And one of the things during the Paris Commune is they really, you know, thought a bit more about their work, and it really added dignity to working class lives by talking about actually the art that was involved. And Napoleon was a shoemaker and talked extensively about the art of shoemaking. I wonder what sort of discussions and debates he could have had with the women of the Cortex strike about what sort of art goes into making a shoe that's also a weapon against the class enemy.